All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hey peoples, welcome to a new episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. I'm one of your hosts, Caitlin Bailey, and I have with me my co-host, Mark Bigney. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing all right, Caitlin. Technical problems notwithstanding, it's been a bad week for technology here in MFED world, but how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, thank you. So today, as always, we're going to start with discussing the games we've been playing lately. Then we're going to follow that up with discussion of the retro game Aladdin, both versions. And then our feature title, Caves of Cood. Finally, we'll wrap it up by shouting out upcoming titles we're looking forward to. So Mark, what have you been playing lately?
I can start off by observing what I haven't played this week, and it's a bad sign. I have not played any more Dragon Age Veilguard, and that's not great. It's a millstone around my neck, Caitlin. It's just mounting and mounting. I plan on finishing it before the year is out. That is a goal. It is an aspiration. We'll see if it comes to pass, and then maybe I'll feel liberated and I'll just come forth and I'll be able to smell the flowers and feel the grass beneath my toes, despite the fact that everything is frozen. But one thing that I have been playing this week is a game called Ruiner. I mentioned recently how I was going through a book called Run and Gun by Bitmap Publishing that talks a lot about run and gun games, for which I have a great deal of enthusiasm. And it had pointed me to Exit the Gungeon, which was sort of counterpart to Enter the Gungeon. And I found that good for some laughs, although it didn't quite work to its strengths as much as I would like. And another game that it mentioned was Ruiner, which is a isometric perspective twin stick shooter thing. And I do so enjoy my twin stick shooters. And I couldn't help but notice that it was in the backlog of, I believe it was a humble key that I'd never actually cashed in. So clearly something that was front of mind. I've generally been discovering, this is true of a retro game that our listeners are asking us to do in the next couple weeks as well. Before buying anything, even if it's 80% off and just a couple dollars, it's worth, in my case, at least spending a couple minutes seeing, is it available for free from here? Is it available for free from there? Have you already bought it in Steam? Have you already bought it elsewhere and not redeemed it on Steam? Sometimes you get surprising little delights.
Yeah.
Anyhow, because I love saving money. I love trying to save listeners money by talking a lot about games on Game Pass and the like. But at any rate, Ruiner is a game that I had purchased. It is from 2017. And straight off the bat, I was shocked that an indie game from 2017 had as much difficulty running. Now, there weren't any huge technical problems. It made my PC's fans squeal like a banshee, and it made my handheld PCs very upset with respect to the technical demands being placed on it, because once again, this is what we would call an unoptimized version of Unreal 4.
Okay.
But I persevered. And I don't like the aesthetic. It's a very, very heavy cyberpunk sort of red and black kind of bleak future. Nothing but corporate cruelty and non-corporate cruelty and counter-corporate cruelty. Did I mention that there's cruelty? And I'm not a huge fan of that vibe. It's not my preferred element either visually or tonally. But nonetheless, I found the gameplay very, very well calibrated to my tastes. I was already digging the systems. I was already digging the balance between melee and gunplay. And then it kept layering on additional systems at just the right pace. I've talked before, especially in the context of twin stick games, where you have to be very judicious and careful with what you're going to do with your shoulder buttons, because I can get very confused very quickly once there are too many functions that need to be layered on, especially if it's supposed to be a twitch-based, flow-based kind of game that's meant to really get you in the zone and dialed into some frenetic action. But Ruiner is just about perfect, especially since the upgrade system encourages maximal flexibility. I remember back in the day where it was extremely expensive to respec, where you might have to go visit a certain place and pay a lot of in-game currency or something to respec all your skills. Increasingly, I appreciate the fact that whether it's an RPG or anything else, you can respec whenever, however you want. That is great. That is a development of modern game design that I approve of.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, When you realize that you've done everything wrong and you need to redo it, further punishing you by making you spend a lot of currency is not my favorite thing in the world.
Well put. And Runer leans into this. So there are a variety of different grenade types, for example. And you might level up and unlock a new grenade type. Well, you can just strip all the build points you've put into the other grenades and put in a new one, because rather than mapping on a whole bunch of different functions, there's just one grenade button and it uses whatever type of grenade you've decided to upgrade. Fine, great. It also is an approach to weaponry that I very much appreciate in games of this ilk. Like, I've played the new Doom games off and on for a while. I liked the first one quite a bit. Doom Eternal I like less well, but it is very neat. But I quite appreciate the approach that Ruiner takes to weaponry, which is when you pick up a gun, it's got a certain amount of ammo, and that's it. And then it's done. Then you throw it away. And then you might pick up another gun, or you might just be forced to use the sort of default pistol. The default pistol is the only thing with unlimited ammo. And so you never really feel like you're saving anything. It just encourages you, not entirely unlike my comment about Exit the Gungeon, that you're always just encouraged to use whatever you've got. There's no point saving it. Some dead dude will drop something else later, and you're not accumulating ammo and marshaling, oh, what weapon should I use? Oh, I'm at my ammo limit over here. Should I start using, ooh, I should use my less favorite weapon because I want to save my favorite weapon from, no. Use what you got. Run into the next one. You'll be fine. On top of that, when a stage is done, I love this. It drops what's called a weapon grinder. There's this pylon that just drops in the middle of the stage. You activate it, and it just mulches all the guns from your dead enemies into experience points and one new gun. Oh. And so you don't have to worry about picking through the wreckage. Oh, is my favorite type? No. Whatever the grinder gives you is better. And you'll get a bunch of experience points besides. I really appreciated that. And then on top of all this, again, every new step was like, oh, that's cool, that's neat. It has glory kills in more or less the exact same way that Doom and Doom Eternal do, which was a great innovation. I kind of wish, though, that they worked a little bit actually more like Doom does. In Doom, you can only activate a glory kill by getting up close and personal with the enemy. And that was one of the reasons why the design is so good, because it encourages forward momentum and actually not hanging back and taking pot shots at people. In Ruiner, the range is a little longer than I'd like. You kind of jump an unrealistic distance in order to do your little glory kill animation, which then tends to spew out a whole bunch of power-ups. I wish that it would force you to dash and get a little bit closer. Other than that, though, I have to say that Ruiner is really good. It's really good at getting you into that flow state. It's marvelous Twitch-based gaming. Gives you a little bit of experimentation with respect to the upgrades, but again, you never really feel like you're committing to anything, and it just encourages the reckless sense of abandon. Like, when I'm engaged in a hyper-frenetic, hyper-kinetic, violent orgy of gunplay and death, I don't want to feel like I have to resource manage, frankly. Not everything needs to have the same vibe as an accountancy spreadsheet or a survival horror game. And so even games like Doom, where you're encouraged to manage health and ammo, that's not my favorite element of it. This is not a criticism of those games. I'm just saying that I think that Ruiner calibrates things slightly better. I want every room to have me start off at full health. I want every room to encourage me to just go out and not worry about saving anything. And Ruiner does those things. And the twin stick action combined with a surprisingly good emphasis on melee does a wonderful job of evoking all those action elements that I very much appreciate playing. I wish it were slightly better technically optimized, as I say, because I've got a lot of handheld PCs and they're not a huge fan of running Ruiner. But as it is, I'm very glad I picked it up whenever I picked it up, wherever I picked it up, for whatever quantity of money I picked it up. So that's Ruiner.
I'm proud of you for going and playing a game that you apparently bought quite some time ago.
This is one of the glories of All My Best Friends Are Digital, Caitlin. I am encouraged to go and examine my back catalog and not just feel daunted by the list of unplayed games and do another run of Risk of Rain, but actually to experience it. Now, as I say, part of this I was also encouraged by reading through this most excellent book, Run and Gun. And so far, the recommendations have been precisely on point, and it's caused me to take a look at some games that I dismissed without having tried them, and it's also caused me to look back into my back catalog. I've got to say that so far, our tastes are very, very much aligned. As I mentioned when initially mentioning the book, if they talk about Shock Troopers and talk about how more people need to be talking about Shock Troopers and playing Shock Troopers, I knew I was onto something, so it was with that sense of confidence that I installed Ruiner.
Nice.
What have you been up to, Caitlin?
Well, I did not go go into my backlog. I bought a new game.
That's fine. That's fine, Caitlin.
So I picked up Uncle Chop's Rocket Shop.
All right, then.
It was developed by Beard Envy and released December 2024. And in Uncle Chop's Rocket Shop, you play a four-eyed fox man who's naturally named Wilbur. And the first thing that you do is you help deal with the body of your predecessor, who is dead with a knife in his back. So, cool. We're off to a good start. So it's a roguelite spaceship repair simulator.
With the occasional murder for no reason?
Well, I don't know. Maybe not no reason. I can't recall if they actually say why he's been murdered. But you will get murdered if you don't pay your rent on time.
Okay. So the murder was not a one-off.
I don't believe it was, no.
Sorry, there's a lot of information for me to process. I'm trying to grapple with it as much as I can.
Yeah, with Uncle Chop's Rocket Shop.
Yeah.
So you are put to work for Uncle Chop's Rocket Shop. You're fixing up the customers' rockets that come in. Each rocket has this to-do list of items that need to get fixed. And there's a variety of different ship systems that you'll have to learn in order to deal with all these things that need to be fixed. Early game, you start with some pretty simple fixes, like refilling fuel, changing out oil. But later in the game, you end up doing things that are much more difficult and sometimes much more deadly, such as dealing with unstable reactor cores that'll explode if you don't deal with them quickly enough. And then that ends your run. So anyway, luckily, there's reference handbook that will walk you through everything you need to check for every single system. The quality of that reference book varies a bit. I feel that it describes some tasks really well, and others I had to go look up how to do because the reference book didn't do it for me, and I didn't want to mess up or die for no reason. So anyway, the game is new enough that there's not a whole lot of guides out there. I ended up having to look at YouTube, which is not my favorite thing. I hate when I just want to know something that I think somebody could describe easily in like a screenshot and a little bit of text and have to watch like a 3-minute video. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. There's two game modes. Oh, there's Frantic and whatever the chiller game mode is, which I don't recall what it's called off the top of my head. With Frantic, you're timed and you get to deal with as many customers as you can deal with within the time limit. With the more chill game mode, you only have 3 customers a day. You are more heavily penalized for making mistakes, but you can take as much time as you want solving all of the problems with the ships. So that's what I did. I tried the more frantic mode, and it stressed me out way too much. I was like, I don't know how to do any of these things. I need to be looking at this book constantly. I can't do this. But yeah, it was fun. It felt at times a little bit like work.
It sounds an awful lot like work. I mean, frankly, you're describing all these things, like cross-referencing reference books in the game. And I'm like, Caitlin, you didn't want to do the 30-second tutorial for Prince of Persia. Why are you playing this game that causes you to look up real-world references to buttress the insufficiencies of the in-game reference that you're, in theory, playing for fun?
Yeah, I can't answer that, I guess. I guess part of it is the art was cute. I enjoyed the game's sense of humor, and I wanted to see what would happen.
What if every tutorial replaced the main character with, like, some sort of weird, cute corgi or something? I don't know. Would this work better for your fear of tutorials? Sorry, fear is the wrong word. Detestation of tutorials?
Yeah, my disdain.
Yeah.
Perhaps. I think... So, let me rewind a little. One of the things that helped with Uncle Chop's Rocket Shop is that it starts, so you get to the start screen, and there's something that says new run, and next to it says play tutorial ? With a checkbox that's already checked. And I was like, you know what? Sure, fine. I'm not going to uncheck you, because that would seem petty.
Oh, wow. This is the weakest form of opt-in versus opt-out inducement I've ever heard of. Whatever works, I guess.
I mean, in Prince of Persia, I thought that I would be able to move my character on the screen. I didn't realize that accidentally tapping right would just start the game. And yes, I could have restarted, and I didn't. And that's on me.
My intention, Caitlin, was not to relitigate the past. Let us not go back to your, let's be charitable and say, rationalizations for why you've done what you've done in the past. I was just curious about your current set of rationalizations for why you've done what you've done with Uncle Choppy's Rocket Choppy.
That's pretty close, yeah.
Choppy, Rocket, Slappy, Shop.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that there was a little bit of satisfaction in learning how to deal with all the systems to the point where eventually I wouldn't have to check the reference manual for them. And I realize, like, just even saying it, I'm like, why did you have fun with that, Caitlin? Stop. Like, stop talking. It doesn't make any sense. But whatever. It's fun. Some of the systems could have been explained better. I did end up finishing a run. And honestly, I don't know. So it seems like there's quite a bit to do. There's multiple endings. You can go down multiple paths. I did the magpie path for what that's worth. I probably will go back to it at some point, and I probably will also face frantic mode one day, but today is not that day.
Could you just describe what one of the tasks you do in this game?
Sure. So with one of them...
And anything, just because I don't have a good sense of what you actually do.
Okay. So one of them is you have to fix the rebreather module. So you have to move the ship around until you find where that panel is. You open it up. You get these little tools. You have a screwdriver and like a hex wrench thingy. So anyway, you go to it, you open it up, and then there's these little tubes on the side that get filled with gas, and it's blue, and you're like, okay, so let me look at the manual, and you learn that if it's breathable gas, the gas should be purple, not blue. So, okay. So then you look there and it's like, if it's not producing breathable gas, then maybe something's wrong with the snails or the environment inside. And yes, I did say snails. So you can open up the rebreather module and there's this tiny little globe inside that has, you know, some tiny little trees, like little baby shrubbery and snails. And you get to see, you know, are the trees dead? Are there enough snails? Do the snails need food? You know, you can check to see if the gas filter is broken. So basically, you just go through this laundry list of items that you need to make sure are good. And once they're all good, hopefully the gas is breathable and purple. And you close it all up. And then that task is done. And I mean, it feels exactly like just, you know, you're debugging a problem. You're trying to figure out exactly what's broken. And then you fix it.
That is very edifying. Thank you. It sounds like, Caitlin, you're very good with the lucky.
Yes. Yeah, that's me.
And what makes it roguelite exactly? You say there are runs and there's the constant threat of murder by not payment of rent.
Yes. So every time you finish a job, you get paid. You may actually have to pay money instead of getting paid if you sufficiently messed enough stuff up. So one example is I was trying to steal something from one of them, and I broke their security system while doing it.
Magpie run indeed.
That cost me $500, and it meant that I earned negative money for the whole day, which was really rough. Luckily, I was able to make up for it on other days and still pay my rent. But basically, you go through a few days of missions, you get or lose whatever amount of money you're going to get or lose based on how you perform in those repair missions, I guess. And then after a few days, you owe rent, so you have to pay rent. There's bosses every now and then. I think roughly every 3 or 4 days, I think there's a boss, which is like, I mean, one time literally it's your boss who comes and, you know, needs to have his ship fixed and you have to do it. And I guess like the slower you are, the more tasks kind of get added on. He's like, okay, well, you know, why are you taking so long? You should change my oil too, kind of thing. But yeah, so the thing that makes it roguelike is, of course, if you fail to pay rent, you will die. And occasionally something may happen during the run that'll get you killed. One example that I mentioned earlier was the reactor. Apparently some ships can land, which are just about ready to explode. So you have to very quickly... Basically, you get your to-do list printed out from the computer, and it says, reactor, check reactor, like, you know, in all caps and everything. Because as soon as a ship has a reactor, there's a risk that, you know, something could be wrong with it. So you check, you have to make sure, like, are the fuel levels correct? Is there enough coolant? Is the, you know, check the stability of the the reactor core itself. If it's about to blow, you can actually take it out safely. You have to do it in a very particular order. But anyway, yeah, if it blows up, you die, you end the run, and you go back. There's a little bit of progression that you can do via these, I don't know, there's this like weird eldritch horror, not really horror, that's like a difficult thing to say, but I don't know, spooky tentacle monster stuff kind of in the the seedy underbelly.
If the ventilation system saliently features tiny little mystical snails, I would imagine that the reactor's got something going on.
Yeah, you fix ships. It's fun. You get special coins that you can use to upgrade things permanently, or not even upgrade things, but get upgrades such as being able to move a little bit faster, being able to earn more money. There's one where it's like, it's a cuteness upgrade, and because you're so cute, if you break something, it costs you 10% less or something like that.
I can't stay mad at that face.
Yeah, exactly.
I understand completely that it may sound difficult to communicate the appeal of games of that ilk because it does indeed sound like work. I have, in the past, felt the appeal of games of that nature. So I'm not completely blind to the joy of something that looks an awful lot like work. And it certainly seems like there's a lot of weird stuff going on top of the work. It was specifically the cross-referencing reference manuals that made me think that this was not your scene.
Yeah, I completely agree. That really doesn't sound like something that I would enjoy. But I think that the satisfaction of learning how to do stuff and then being able to deal with it more and more quickly helps that a lot.
Well, we'll see if that enthusiasm carries through to our feature game later, but let us move on from, okay, let me see if I can get this name right. Uncle Chop's Rocket Shop?
Yes, that's it.
Okay, splendid. Nailed it. Uncle Chop's Rocket Shop to our gaming opinions on old school funware, aka Goof. We've decided to do doubleheader. We're going to be wading knee deep into an ongoing roiling controversy within retro gaming, and that is the tale of the two Aladdins. So there was an Aladdin released in October of 93. And there was an Aladdin released in November of 93, the first one for the Sega Genesis, aka Mega Drive, and the other one for the Super Nintendo, the first one by Virgin Interactive, the second one by Capcom. And they are, in some ways, very similar games. In other ways, they are very different games. And if you watch a whole bunch of retro gaming YouTubers, some of them, when showing you hypothetical 16-bit game, will show you the Genesis Aladdin, and some people, when showing you hypothetical 16-bit video game, will show you the Super Nintendo Aladdin. And so I was somewhat curious to develop... I like having opinions on controversies. Like, I went through a period once where I made, like, six batches of fried chicken one after the other because I just wanted to have an opinion on whether or not you should soak fried chicken in buttermilk before you fry it. Answer, by the way, is yes. And so I was very keen to see what was going on with these Aladdins. But I have to say, Caitlin, your claims of not being a Disney person are getting feebler by the day because this was your idea.
It was my idea, yes. The SNES Aladdin. Okay, to be fair, the SNES Aladdin was a huge part of my childhood, partly because I was a child at the time. So I think that gets me a pass.
Okay. And I will say, of the Disney movies, probably, I think there's probably only like two Disney movies for which I have strong positive associations. One of them is Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. And that was because when I was a kid, it was on the Wonderful World of Disney or the Magical World of Disney, something like that. I taped it on the VCR, watched that VCR tape all the darn time. And I did very much enjoy the Aladdin movie. I borrowed it from my high school friend Richard and thoroughly enjoyed that. Even though I'm not a big fan, I mean, the guy's dead, rest in peace, but I'm not a huge Robin Williams fan. I confess I find him a little tiresome. But anyway, and some of the comments in the Aladdin movie have not aged well, like the part where they keep calling it barbaric. You don't really need to do that. It's a little farther than you need to go, but whatever. It was a simpler time.
Yes.
So you have childhood experiences with the Super Nintendo version. I assume you had not previously then played the Genesis version.
That's correct.
I believe in the 90s it was illegal to own multiple consoles of the same generation.
Yes, accurate.
It was the days of the console wars. So you came in with a fair amount of bias then, right?
I certainly did. And I don't think my bias has changed in any way whatsoever, but that's okay.
Why don't you tell us then about the two Aladdins?
All right. I don't have much in my notes about the SNES version because I can admit openly that a great deal of my love for it is based in nostalgia, and it's very difficult for me to separate the nostalgia from anything even remotely looking like objectivity. So anyway.
Well, we are professional journalists here at All My Best Friends Are Digital, Caitlin, so
yes,
I, for one, am very disappointed. I don't think this was on your disclosure form when you first joined this fine journalistic enterprise.
It was not. But the SNES version, like I said, Aladdin, it was one of my childhood games. I love it. The platforming was really fun. I love the music. The graphics were good, although I do have to say that the Genesis version mostly blows the SNES out of the water graphics-wise. Like, it looks really, really good. I think that in some cases, the graphics on the Genesis one, it's not that they were... I don't know. Sometimes I felt that it was difficult to tell what was interactable, where a path was. And I don't know if that was... I mean, okay, that probably is not actually related to the graphics. It's more related to, you know, they probably just could have spent a little bit more time level design-wise to make things more obvious. But anyway, yeah, and then the Genesis version turns Aladdin into a straight-up killer with a sword. So...
When one looks into online discourse about the two Aladdins, the general view, I think, the sort of broad consensus, fragile though it may be, because again, this is a roiling controversy and we are once again descending in to decades-old console wars discussions,
yeah,
is that the Genesis version is better because it's got better animation and Aladdin has a sword. And for what it's worth, that is the judgment of Shinji Mikami. Shinji Mikami, famed game designer who worked on the Super Nintendo version of Aladdin, and he says that were it not for his participation in the Super Nintendo project, he would have preferred the Genesis version because Aladdin has better animation and he's got a sword.
Why does him having a sword make it better?
I am with you, Caitlin, 110%. The Genesis version looks great. Aladdin, yeah, is indeed a bigger sprite, better animation. But what the hell is he doing running around slashing the crap out of all those things?
It doesn't make any sense.
It's bizarre. Not only does it not make any sense, it doesn't feel good. I strongly disliked the Genesis version at first, even before. And I tried the Genesis version first. I decided to do it in chronological order.
Okay.
It does a couple of things that I'm willing to just stipulate are, I think, mediocre game design. One of them, and this happens all the time in games of that era, you're running around, and as per usual, it's a side-scrolling affair, and the screen moves in relation to how far you're moving side to side. Well, look, you can't have it so that your character is right up against the edge of the screen as the screen is panning over, right? You can't have it so that you see, like, 20 feet behind you and only 5 feet ahead of you. That is not the way to do things. And the story of the Genesis version for much of the time is, here I am running around, an enemy shows up, and before I even have any time to react, because it's so close to me at this point, I've got a dagger chucked in my face.
Yep.
On top of that, the fact that Aladdin's got a sword is beside the point, because it makes far more sense to pelt them with apples and see them explode. Which, to the best of my understanding, is not what happens when you pelt someone with apples, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I've never done it, so...
That's a good point. We have not yet tried a stereotypical turban man juggling swords, how he reacts to being pelted with apples. He might well explode. I don't know. Contrast that with the Super Nintendo version, where you use apples to stun people, and then you just have Aladdin vault over them. And this is a small difference, but I think it's salient, and it's one of the reasons why I think the Genesis version can look so good much of the time. Mm-hmm. And then you see a sort of goofy image of the character... like goggle-eyed or dizzy or whatever, leaving the screen through the bottom. They just sort of like exit the screen rather than disappearing in a puff of smoke and a lightning blast. they literally explode. It doesn't matter how you kill them in the Genesis version, pelting with apples or swords. By the way, pelting with apples makes much more sense. It's safer. But I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't get it. I do not remember Aladdin decapitating hordes of guards with a sword in the movie.
Weirdly, I also don't remember that.
Yeah, clearly we need to go back to the movie because then we would understand things better. And on top of that, the platforming in the Genesis version, I would go so far as to say it's mediocre. It's not even just average. I never got the sense of how far I was able to jump. Mm-hmm. Aligning Aladdin so he will climb up a rope or a ladder was tricky.
Oh my god, I never it was quite so annoying.
Figured it out. Mm-hmm. I would run off the edge of ledges all the time because you kind of have to hit jump a little bit before you think you might have to.
Yep.
Whereas in the Super Nintendo version, the platforming is tight and it's visually appealing and it's cool. Aladdin is vaulting over low rocks. He's swinging off of poles. He's bouncing off of various enemies. I was never confused. You could show me the design language of the Super Nintendo version was sufficiently well done that you could show me a new heretofore unseen aspect of the terrain and I would know how it would act.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had been trained to use Aladdin's movement abilities in such a way that it was consistently done and I knew what was going on. Whereas the Genesis version felt like a floaty mess.
Yeah, I mean, there was this one part in the Genesis version where, okay, so I sort of liked how some of the levels had a little bit of a sense of depth where, like, you know, you could zigzag across the same area or whatever.
Fair.
But there was one area where first I climb on a vine over some spikes and then I drop down and then I get to move to the right and I'm going kind of in front slash underneath the spikes. But I jumped and took damage from the spikes. And I was like, no, that's not how this works.
I would frequently find myself in a position not knowing why I was taking damage in the Genesis version. Among them, and this is such a common design flaw in so many games of that ilk, particularly of Castlevania games, but not just Castlevania games, rats and bats, they should never be enemies in platforming games of this
ilk. Oh my god,
They will be so much deadlier than anything. Like, you can put a fire-breathing dragon in your game, but a stupid bat will be take off vastly more life. I played, not too long ago, I played the TurboGrafx-16 CD Castlevania game, which is widely regarded as one of the best Castlevania games. And stupid bats, man, just dumb bats will take off more of your life. And the Genesis Aladdin has so many stupid freaking bats. I will grant you that the level design in the Genesis version is a lot more inventive and it's more sprawling, but at a cost. The cost is I frequently don't know where I'm going to land. The design language of the levels is such that it's just opaque. I don't know if I'm going to be going up or down. Is that a mountable staircase? Is that a thing I can jump on or not a thing I can jump on?
Yeah.
Is this a wall that I'm in the foreground of, or is this wall going to block progress? Oh, I guess it's blocking progress. Okay, where to now? Now, you get a little bit of a sense of exploration, a little bit of sense of development, a little bit of depth, as you say, but I think the cost isn't worth it, frankly.
There was also, were they ropes or snakes coming out of jars? And then
magic ropes. Another staple of the movie.
You grab on and it just flies up to a designated point and then you're allowed to jump off and then it disappears. Like, what?
Yeah.
It was very odd.
Now, I will say that overall, I think that the Super Nintendo version is too easy. And if I were a gamer in the mid-90s, and I had to pay my $60 to $70 for a cartridge, and that's all I got out of it, I would be somewhat disappointed, perhaps, as to the length. But I mean this sincerely. I think the Super Nintendo Aladdin is one of the biggest joyous discoveries I've made in retro games since I've just started going through the classics. And people talk about it like it's the poor alternative to the Genesis one. I think it's aggressively delightful. I had a blast playing it.
Mm-hmm.
I came in with no expectations and was completely overwhelmed by how joyous and delightful and the level design was great and the movement felt good. I thought everything was firing on all cylinders, with possible exception of it being too easy, but it was great. You had magic carpet levels. You had silly little genie digressions. It had all the things. And even by the standards of generic sort of platformer action game thing, I thought the Genesis one was just so weak.
Yeah, I thought the Genesis version was fine. You know, you get to do stuff that it is beautiful, but like you mentioned earlier, the design language I thought of the SNES version was just really good. The number of times in the Genesis version where I would walk into a wall because I didn't realize there was a wall there, Like, I thought that maybe it was a pillar in the foreground that I could go behind. Nope, it's a wall. I don't know. I had a lot of little peeves from playing the Genesis version. And I will completely admit that on the SNES version, I remember enough that if there was something like that, I would probably remember it and therefore wouldn't run into a problem anyway. So I can't be completely neutral there. But still.
I came in expecting to prefer the Genesis version because that's what culturally I've been told to expect. But my expectations were completely subverted, and I thought that the SNES game was a joy. When I saw that Shinji Mikami worked on it, I'm like, oh, okay, that kind of makes a little bit of sense. But just to contrast the level design of the Genesis game with the level design of the Super Nintendo, the Super Nintendo levels are comparatively far more linear, but they have valuable gems that are visible and difficult to get to. And mm-hmm. So it's almost it's a little bit like some of the dynamics we were talking about in the context of either Tactical Breach Wizards or of Neon White, right? Where you're going through and it's like, okay, well, just getting to the end is relatively easy. But it's like, oh, I think I kind of know what I'd have to do in order to go get that out of the way thing. Mm-hmm. It's not exploration. It's not secrets laden or anything. But it's just in terms of clear level design, it was like, okay, well, this is the straightforward way. This is the slightly fancy way to go get more gems, which, again, you didn't really need because the game was so easy. I will quibble with a couple things, though, Caitlin. I have some questions. Mm-hmm. Because the one thing that really annoyed me about the Super Nintendo version of Aladdin was indeed the music. They have these 16-bit renditions of Aladdin music, but they're on such short loops. I found it so grating and repetitive and obnoxious.
I was just vibing. I didn't even notice. Yep.
Oh, okay, sure. All right. The second thing that I found incredibly puzzling, I had no idea that you had played the Super Nintendo version as a child.
Yeah.
So now I know that there are two Disney platformers that you played as a child. How on earth, I mean this sincerely, I'm genuinely confused. How could somebody play both the Aladdin Super Nintendo game and the Lion King Super Nintendo game and not immediately recognize that they're on completely different levels of quality?
My excuse is I was somewhere between 8 and 10 years old, and just having fun playing a Disney game.
So what you're saying is you are a Disney person.
I mean, you know the answer to that is no.
You're right, that's unfair. 8, 9, 10, that's almost everyone's a Disney person when they're 8, 9, 10 in the 90s. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, thank you for recommending that I try the Super Nintendo version of Aladdin. As to people who swear by the Genesis version, he's got a sword. He does indeed have a sword. If your ranking of games is starts and a first pass with has a sword, has no sword, I will fully grant you the Virgin Genesis version of Aladdin, there's a sword there.
Yep.
Apparently, though I didn't get that far, he doesn't even use the sword in the last boss, which is doubly ironic because the one time Aladdin uses a sword in the movie is against the big snake Jafar. Anyway, setting all that aside.
That's incredible.
With difficulty, we now move on. And now a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
And we're back to our feature game, which is Caves of Cud. I've heard it said Cud.
Cud? Okay.
I've also heard it said Cood. I don't know. This is a roguelike game, which is to say a game like Rogue, in that it's got very stripped-down tile-based graphics. It is turn-based. You've got permadeath. Lots and lots of text. An interface that most of the time doesn't seem to care how accessible it is. And, oh my goodness, infinite hours of gameplay and so many weird forms of combinatorics. So this is sort of a sci-fi, post-apocalyptic world that has been inspired by such role-playing settings as Gamma World, for those that are familiar. I don't know if you have any experience with Gamma World, Caitlin, or indeed roguelikes in general. Is this your first roguelike?
It might be.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So this entered beta in 2010. It entered early access in 2015. It's been on my wish list since about 2017. And it reached 1.0 in December of 2024, this month. Now, interesting story. So Kit Fox, which are the publishers of Caves of Cud, this is designed by Freehold Games, they are the same people who kind of dragged Dwarf Fortress kicking and screaming onto Steam in a 1.0 release. And okay, they signed up with Freehold a while ago and they said, we will turn your Caves of Cud into something that idiots like Mark will recognize as a real game. And so sure enough, they've done that. Turns out that Kit Fox, for what it's worth, is based in Montreal, and they are also developers, and they developed Boyfriend Dungeon, which was a game that I very much wanted to like, but sadly couldn't. Did you play Boyfriend Dungeon?
I did, yeah.
And what did you think of it?
It was fun. I mean, I didn't think it was very deep, I guess, but I enjoyed a playthrough.
I didn't find quite enough to grab me. I felt that everything was just a little lacking, but the conceit is ultimately charming. The conceit is that you date slash wield various individuals in like overland dialogue sections and then dungeon crawling bits where they turn into weapons. So you want to date a rapier? This is your chance to date a rapier.
Yep. Yeah, very odd.
Not many games let you do that. I mean, say what you want about Caves of Cud. There's a lot of things that you can do in that game. Dating a rapier, I don't think is one of them. Although I could be mistaken. I don't know.
Yeah, it could happen. There's a lot of game that I haven't played.
Sure. What do you think about Caves of Cud, Caitlin?
Okay. I realize that I don't think I've ever played a game like this before. I have seen games like it, but I've never played Dwarf Fortress or Rogue, or whatever other one. I've never played a game like this. So first I did the tutorial because Mark asked me to, and I said I would.
Thank you, Caitlin. I sincerely appreciate that.
And that was that was okay. I got through a little bit. I did a handful of runs in the standard permadeath mode. So after losing multiple characters, please rest in peace, Beep Boop, Vitamin Water, Pizza, and iPhone, I started an adventure game with my character, Bert's Bees, and that one has gone pretty well. So I would say that Beep Boop died because an enemy exploded and I didn't know it was going to explode, so that's on me. Well, I mean, they're all on me, I guess. But Vitamin Water, Pizza, and iPhone all died because I was going through a cave, having a good time, enemies were fairly easy, and then all of a sudden came an enemy that said average difficulty, but I couldn't deal damage to and couldn't get away from and died. So that was unfortunate. But it's, I don't know, I've been having fun. I feel like I still don't understand most of the game. Every now and then I kill something and it's like, hey, these people hate you now. And I'm like, oh, okay, I don't know who they are, but sorry for killing your friend, the dragonfly.
Maybe if the dragonfly hadn't picked a fight with me.
Yeah. Yeah, it shouldn't have done that. So whose fault is this really? But yeah, I've been having fun. I did the first few main quests. I helped out the engineer person with a few quests. I collected a whole bunch of copper wire for him. Or them. I don't know. I don't know the gender of anything in this game, and that's okay. And then another quest I did is I went to the sixth stilt. I don't know. I did a handful of things, though. I explored a lot. I thought I really liked when you're exploring the overworld map. You know, you can discover a lair and you can go visit, and it marks it on your map so you can come back to it later. That's the kind of thing, actually, that I feel like a game like this, it actually does. Versus if this game existed 20 years ago, it'd be like, no, Caitlin, you have to remember exactly what grid on the map that thing was. And I hope you have your, you know, encyclopedia-sized notebook next to your desk so you can write all of these things down.
The story of the development of more modern roguelikes is often one of better quality of life improvements.
Mm-hmm.
So the first roguelike I ever played was NetHack. So-called, by the way, it's one of those very misleading titles. It's called NetHack because it is the online collaborative implementation of an original game called Hack. It has nothing to do with actual hacking. It's just the version of Hack that was collaboratively developed on the internet. And it's just, you're in a dungeon, you go down the dungeon. My favorite one is Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, which is very much like NetHack in that you're just in a dungeon, you're going down the dungeon. There are some other levels that aren't really a dungeon, but they're basically dungeons. And there's no overland, there's no wandering about. And I will say this, I have a bad track record lately. I have no leg to stand on. I'm a raving hypocrite because I keep giving Caitlin difficulty for skipping tutorials. But then again, the past couple of games that I've recommended to her, they've had bad tutorials that set her up for failure. Now, I will say that the tutorial for Caves of Cud has more justification because there's a million things that it could cover, and so it deliberately chose not to cover a lot of them. Mm-hmm. The tutorial for Sifu, there's no apology for that. There's no excusing the tutorial for Sifu. The tutorial for Sifu is garbage and should feel ashamed of itself. But the tutorial for Caves of Cud leaves out a couple things that I definitely would have included. One of them is auto-explore.
Yes.
Because you can waste hours literally just filling out a map. But with the magical implementation of the zero key, your little character goes around and just automatically fills out the map and stops when it encounters something violent. Now, in terms of quality of life, and just to give you a sense of how, I'll use the word sophisticated Caves of Cud is, you can alter the threshold that will stop your auto-explore. If you just want to walk past low-level enemies that might try to attack you but can't possibly be worth your time, you can tell it to do that, and you'll just wander past and never give a care. If you want to change the speed at which the screen represents your auto-exploration, you can do that too. There are options a-go-go. It's really, really customizable. A lot of roguelikes are, but it can be very, very difficult to do that. The overall interface of Caves of Cud, it's got 1 foot in the modern world and 1 foot in the old ASCII text-based world. You can do things like, I was doing things just second nature, like hitting the I key to open up my inventory. But if you don't want to do that, you can use a gamepad and hit start and then tab over to your inventory screen and then move your cursor over to the little slot next to your hands and then equip something that way. These are all options, and they've done a reasonably good job of that level of flexibility. I do think, though, that the tutorial was a little more elliptical than it needed to be. Because I think elliptical is also a very good way for Caves of Cud. I've played Caves of Cud a fair bit over the course of the past week. I don't have a good sense about anything. Like, the background of the world, what the various factions want or do, various turns of phrase, idioms. Now, I'm having fun getting lost. And by getting lost can mean one of a million things in Caves of Cud, because in the overworld you can literally get lost. But I don't feel like I'm moored yet. I don't feel like I have a grounding in what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people say that Caves of Cud is a good introductory roguelike, I think that's half true and half completely gonzo bonkers.
Yeah, a good introduction to a roguelike if... when you think of roguelike, you think of certain other, even more difficult to parse games. Then sure, yeah.
Okay, saying Caves of Cud is a good intro roguelike is kind of like saying that the Genesis Aladdin is better because Aladdin has a sword. One of the things that Caves of Cud is adduced to have that makes it newbie-friendly is you can very easily play on by just using a gamepad. That's true. Is it easier to hold left trigger and then press Y as opposed to hitting zero to do auto explore? I don't think so. But if you're completely petrified of keyboard inputs, then yeah, Caves of Cud is a better choice than lots of other roguelikes that only use keyboard inputs. Sure, fine. But I think that's the wrong question. I think the better question for is this a good thing to recommend as a good starter roguelike is, do things make sense? Will they be able to understand what's going on? So, for example, just for context, there's a game called Jupiter Hell, which is the sort of glossy, graphicked-up version of the Doom roguelike. There was a Doom roguelike. The roguelike community, they make roguelikes out of lots of things. And there was it just took the structure of Doom and made it a roguelike. And they made it turn-based. Instead of picking up swords and axes and stuff, you're picking up a pistol and a shotgun, and you're reloading and all those other things. And it yanked a lot of the sound assets from Doom and so got into copyright trouble. But anyway, but Jupiter Hell is a rogue version of Doom. And in Doom, let's be frank, you're not doing a whole heck of a lot of stuff. You don't have a bunch of lore and weird artifacts that you need to identify, and 50 different sub-mechanisms that you may or may not be messing with, and a weird skill system, and mutations, and the ability to rebuke robots, and. So if you're a beginner, all the tutorial needs to tell you is, like, here's how you walk around, here's how you equip things, here you pick things up, here's how you shoot, go forth.
Yeah.
Caves of Cud? You can learn all those things, and the tutorial will tell you some of those things, but past that, you are on your own.
Yeah. So I did not play with the gamepad, mostly because I couldn't imagine how it would work. So I didn't try, to be fair.
Sure.
So I played with keyboard. I think the first thing that bit me was I was constantly trying to use WASD instead of the arrow keys to move around. And it wasn't until Mark mentioned that you can use the numpad 0 in Caves of Cud to auto-explore. That was a revelation that completely changed my life.
Yeah. The tutorial for Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, by the way, leans into that. They're like, look, don't bother. You only need to move around using the arrow keys when it's just fine-grained individual movement in combat. They pretty much tell you only suckers use the arrow keys most of the time. Just use Auto Explore. It'll save a lot of your life. And so I was playing Caves of Cud, and the way you move in Caves of Cud, by the way, is you hold down the direction, and then you hit the right trigger on your gamepad, which works real well. But if you get confused and think that it works the way it works in almost every other game, where you hold down the trigger and then do something, where the trigger enables, you're just going to stand there waiting for 5 turns while something nibbles on your ankles. I died a number of times that way. And after playing for a few hours, I was literally in a position like, there's got to be an auto-explorer. Come on.
Yeah.
But if there's an auto-explorer, the tutorial would have talked about it, right? Because I first learned about auto-explorer through the tutorial in Dungeon. There's got to be an auto-explorer. And a quick Googling later, it's like, oh, there's an auto-explorer, all right. And it works exactly the way you'd think it does. And yeah, it saves so much time.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So I guess the other thing that I struggled with a little bit was, so once I got the auto-explorer thing figured out, it was really easy generally to wander around and then like move toward enemies. But if they were ever at a diagonal, I didn't know how to attack them on my keyboard. Like, I could use my mouse to click on them and do that. But otherwise, at the keyboard, all I had to do was use an arrow key to either go left or up or whatever. But I couldn't go diagonal with my arrow keys.
Well, there's a number of... Okay, well... it's a whole thing. It won't use the WASD, but there are keyboard keys for the diagonals. I can't remember what they are for CUD. In Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, they're Y, U, B, and N. Those are the diagonals in Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup.
Okay.
There is, for what it's worth, both a gamepad and keyboard command for melee attack enemy with whom I'm engaged.
Oh.
So that simplifies matters as well.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of things that are there to be found that CUD will not tell you about that will simplify your life.
Yeah, you better go look in the controls section of the settings menu.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why I recommended Caves of CUD, not only because it's been on my wish list for almost a decade, but because, again, I had been told, I'm a credulous boy, I'm just a naïf. I'm like a naive little ingenue suckered in by people on the internet.
Yeah.
It's a miracle I haven't fallen victim to any multi-level marketing over the course of my life. It said Caves of Cud is wonderful and it's great for newbies. I'm like, great. I will suggest this to Caitlin and we'll have a grand old time. I was suckered. I'm the victim here. I really appreciate what Caves of Cud is doing. And I think this is the kind of thing where I'm just going to get lost and slowly allow the world to unfurl itself to me and just wander around. It's got a lot of the same vibes for what it's worth, and this is a bit of a stretch, but I stand by it, as the Bethesda games. If you enjoy, in Bethesda games, just wandering around from place to place and seeing what's up, Caves of Cud has got a lot of that vibe.
Yeah,
and when
sure.
I say getting lost, I mean that both literally and figuratively, and there's a lot of ways to do that. And sometimes it's really frustrating. Like, I'm just coming back to Joppa from the Red Rock, man. I don't need to go get lost and be chewed on by some passing chameleons. Like, well, sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
Next time, develop your skills so you know the terrain better.
That was the other thing. The tutorial, I don't think, ever taught you about how when you level up, you get skill points and you can spend them.
Yeah, the skill system is not transparently communicated. Neither is the mutation system, which is a shame because this is one way, I should stress, that Caves of Cud really is head and shoulders above a lot of other roguelikes. You have so many more interesting tools at your disposal. In a lot of other roguelikes, anything and everything can happen. Like, let me just give you one example. In NetHack, there's a million strange, weird exploits you can have. If you kill a floating eyeball and eat its corpse, when your eyes are closed, you can telepathically sense the location of enemy monsters.
Okay.
So if you have a blindfold, and if you kill a floating eyeball and it leaves behind a corpse, you can eat that, and then every time you put on your blindfold, you can know where the enemies are. Stuff like that. But that is an indication of some of the weird and wonderful things, of which, as I say, there are a million, that can happen in NetHack, but they are driven by the environment. And it might be a while before anything truly interesting happens. So you might spend the first N levels of your experience just whacking low-level enemies with your starting weapon. And that's fine. That's not a complaint. It's fine. Same thing is true to a certain extent of Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, although to a lesser extent. In Caves of Cud, no. You're going to start with some very weird skills that let you do very strange things. You're going to start with some mutations that let you do wild superpower nonsense stuff. And to its credit, the interface is real good at encouraging you to use them often.
Yes.
Right? One of the classic, I've talked before about dying or finishing a game with like bunch of ammo and health potions left. And that is doubly true in roguelikes. But in Caves of Cud, the interface is very good at showing you what skills you've got on cooldown and when your new interesting new powers are ready to go. And so I find myself much less frequently making the mistake of forgetting about all the cool stuff that I can pull out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool. It's fun to play with new toys. And to a certain extent, Cud will just drown you in technological, mutational, and skill-based toys. And that is, I can see why it was in development for 73,000 years. There's a lot of stuff going on and a lot of variables to intersect. And I think it does a reasonably good job of doing that. But again, I think it could have benefited from perhaps maybe an intermediate level tutorial as well as the basic tutorial.
Yeah, that might have been helpful.
Maybe your experienced Caves of Cud spelunkers will accuse me of not having an appropriate enough sense of adventure and of learning by doing, but I'm willing to admit that a slightly better documentation would have made me happy.
Oh, yeah, I also learned. So, okay. Yes, you're definitely encouraged to use your abilities and everything. They're right there on the bottom of the screen. It's great. I got some grenades by examining. I mean, okay, first of all, discovering that I could even examine these artifacts and figure out what they were, that was neat. Didn't know that before I accidentally happened across it. But anyway, I discovered some grenades, and I was like, cool, I should use these one day. And of course, I was like, oh, well, I don't know, I want to save them for whatever. They rusted in my bags. So,
tragic.
Gotta use the grenades. Don't hoard them for some unforeseen future endeavor.
I think, though, to summarize the extent to which Cud is an advancement over some of the ways with which other roguelikes are kind of, I think, almost deliberately obtuse, Let me just give a specific example from something that happens in both NetHack and Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup. You've got armor, and you've got clothing, and you've got rings. One of them you wear, and you do that with the W key. One of them you put on with the P key. That's some nonsense, right?
What?
That's some stone cold, straight up nonsense. One of them you take off with the T key, and one of them you remove with the R key. Also, some straight up nonsense.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So compared to that, yes, Caves of Cud is very user-friendly.
Yeah.
But that's not saying it's particularly user-friendly. I do not recommend Caves of Cud for your first roguelike. I really don't. For one thing, it's relatively cheap. In terms of gameplay, money for gameplay hour, it's one of the best deals going. Frankly, it's around $20 or so, and you can play Caves of Cud for the rest of your natural-born life and probably never encounter the precise same configuration twice. A lot of it's procedurally generated, and there's just so many variables going on. It's impossible to find too much repetition. But I will say that Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup does a better job onboarding you. Yes, the interface, I've just talked about how it's much more obtuse, but it's free and it's much more transparent and it's trying to do less. And so consequently, it's easier to wrap your head around what's going on. So you're not struggling with gameplay elements at the same time as you're trying to struggle with, wait, what's a Sultan again? The Sultan of who? The what now? What do they do? Oh, that's good to know. Thanks. Bye. If you want something that's slightly more, with a slighter, greater degree of graphical polish that's even more stripped down, again, I would recommend Jupiter Hell. But frankly, Jupiter Hell is simple to the point of being borderline simplistic. Mm. But it's good for a little bit. And so it's good to show the formula. In hindsight, I would not have recommended Caves of Cud to you, Caitlin. And this, just because, again, you're not experienced in the genre. This has nothing to do with your capabilities or as a person or as a gamer. It's just I was sold a false bill of goods about Caves of Cud, and so I apologize for passing on my ignorance to you.
Oh, that's quite all right. I mean, so if this hadn't been for the podcast, I don't know that I would have kept playing after the first hour or so. But as it is, I've put 6 to 8-ish, maybe up to 10. I don't know. I put a number of hours in and felt like I was actually getting into it, having fun. Granted, I did switch to the adventurer mode because I was like, I cannot start a brand new character anymore. Like, I am done with that. And I could see maybe someday going back to the more hardcore mode, but not yet.
I think Caves of Cud is going to be with me for a while. This is absolutely a world that I want to explore more of. I want to explore more of the systems. I have barely scratched the surface of anything in Caves of Cud. There's just so much content here, and it's a love letter to the genre. It's clear that they've put a mountain of effort into it, and I'm very pleased that it's now finally in actual release. As I say, I just wish I could recommend it to people who weren't used to this style of game. If you haven't played roguelikes before, then I would recommend you start with Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, which is available for free, or with Jupiter Hell, which is Doom roguelike and is just sort of baby's first roguelike. I don't mean that as a pejorative, but it's a much better introduction to the genre.
Yeah.
Failing that, if you really want to jump into Caves of Cud, after you're done with the tutorial, go on YouTube and start watching some tutorial videos because you're not ready to play yet. You're just not. Unless you really enjoy learning by dying.
Sure.
But even then, you'll waste a lot of time that you don't need to waste. So it's tough. So that's Caves of Cud. I am looking forward to more of it. I'm glad you got something out of it, Caitlin. Once again, I apologize. I will be sure to do a little bit more research next time, and I will be sure to recommend a third game whose tutorial aggressively sets you up for failure.
Sweet. Can't wait.
Maybe I could find, like, mod a game so that it actually has the tutorial of a different game. So we are now going to engage in some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, aka shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out this week?
Okay, so this week I watched the Game Awards, and I have like 3 months of shout content, thanks to the trailers and teasers I saw during it. But the first one I'm going to go with is The Witcher 4. I saw Ciri, and I was like, oh my god, it's a Ciri Witcher game? A Ciri Witcher game? So I lost it. I'm doing a little
and
better now.
I regained consciousness.
Very excited about it. I hope that her braid isn't weirdly right next to her face for the whole game, because that was a little weird. It just in the trailer, she has this big, thick braid that's coming out of her hood right next to her face and down her front. And it just feels like it'd be really annoying. Like, I don't like hair in my face. Anyway, it's fine. I'm excited about The Witcher 4.
In fairness, Witcher game's not known. I mean, Geralt's hair was just, let's be frank, it was gross. It was super gross. I don't understand why anyone was ever willing to touch him, let alone knock boots with him. He was so slimy looking.
Yeah, actually, that's something I have a question about, is given CD Projekt Red and the fact that every previous Witcher game you've been able to, you know, sleep with every single lady practically that you see, what is it going to be like with Ciri? Is Ciri also going to be able to take the express train to Bone Town? Is she only going to be able to do that with women, or will she also be able to do that with non-women? We shall see.
Can I admit something, Caitlin?
Yes.
When I saw that Ciri was going to be the protagonist for Witcher 4, that was one of my first questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. It's a big part of the previous games, you know? So we'll see.
It is. Frankly, I still plan on playing The Witcher 3. I saw an excellent line from Games Journalism saying, if The Witcher 4 is anything like Cyberpunk, we'll be playing it until 2035, which sounds about right. But I may have started The Witcher 3 by the time The Witcher 4 comes out. Who knows?
All right.
Do you know what I need to do first, though, Caitlin?
What do you need to do first?
Finish Dragon Age The Veilguard. Ugh, it's standing in the way. There's this large rook-shaped barrier between me and my rest of my video gaming projects.
You can do it. I believe in you.
Can I, though?
Yes.
Your optimism buoys me. Anyway, I am actually going to go hyper indie for this one. Rabbit and Steel, Caitlin. Rabbit and Steel is going to have a DLC. It's going to have new game modes. It's going to have new bosses, new stuff. New stuff for Rabbit and Steel. I read some updates from Minodev, and they say that they are optimistic that they're going to have a whole bunch of new stuff. They thought about doing little bits of content update here and there, and they said, nah, screw it. We're just going to have a big old DLC with a whole bunch of new stuff available sometime next year. And nice. I am super excited for more Rabbit and Steel. It has been the unexpected delight of the year, and so I cannot wait for more.
Awesome. I'm really excited to hear that, too.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for All My Best Friends Are Digital. We hope to see you again soon. And as ever, take care of yourselves and take care of your hobby time. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guaranteed details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.